United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A new U.S. plan to deliver aid to Gaza is set to begin. A massive ship is heading to the eastern Mediterranean loaded with gear to begin construction of a floating pier to deliver aid to Gaza amid the ongoing conflict. VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells us more.
The United States Army deployed a vessel from Virginia to the Mediterranean carrying equipment to build a temporary pier. While it will likely be weeks, with some estimates as high as 60 days before the pier becomes operational, the plan is to have a floating base of operations to deliver aid to Palestinian territories. The United Nations says a quarter of Gaza's population faces starvation. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says tens of thousands of Hamas terrorists have been killed during Israel's war in Gaza Strip. VOA's Joe Ramsey reports.
Netanyahu said on Sunday at least 13,000 quote-unquote terrorists were among Palestinians killed and vowed to press ahead with an offensive in the south of the enclave, a move U.S. President Joe Biden has described as his red line. Nearly 31,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza during the five-month-long war. Hamas dismisses Israel's toll for militants as an attempt to portray what it calls fake victories. Biden and his aides have urged Netanyahu in strong terms not to launch a major offensive in Rafah until Israel crafts a plan for mass evacuation of civilians. More than half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are sheltering in the Rafah area. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
The leader of Yemen's branch of al-Qaeda is dead, according to the militant group on Sunday. Khalid al-Bakafari has a $5 million bounty on his head from the U.S. government over leading the group al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports the U.S. is flying forces to Haiti for embassy security and some evacuations.
The U.S. military says forces started landing at the embassy in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Sunday, evacuating non-essential personnel. Gangs mainly control the neighborhood around the U.S. compound where violence has been rampant and deadly. Guyana's president, Mohamed Irfan Ali, chairman of CARICOM, is inviting select world leaders, including the U.S., to meet Monday.
The situation on the ground remains dire and is of serious concern to us.
Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who is facing calls to resign or form a transitional council, has been unable to return home after traveling abroad trying to secure a UN-backed police force with no success. I'm Julie Walker.
Religious leaders have seen the crescent moon in Saudi Arabia, home to the holiest sites in Islam, marking the start of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. AP's Rika Ann Garcia reports on this period of religious reflection, family get-togethers, and giving across the Muslim world.
As they savor the traditions, the troubles faced by fellow Muslims are never far from anyone's mind. This year, the war and hunger in Gaza cast a dark shadow over the celebrations. In Rafah, people are seen carrying on with their prayers within the rubble of a mosque that was destroyed. Muslims try to avoid conflict and focus on acts of charity during the holy month. However, the war in Gaza is looming large over this year's Ramadan for many Muslims. I'm Rika Ann Garcia.
Portugal's political future is hanging in the balance after a general election that has left two moderate mainstream parties closely contesting the race in an unprecedented surge in support for a populist party that finished third. They will have to wait weeks for a decision on the winner as a counting of the votes cast abroad decide the distribution of four seats. The center-right Social Democrat-led Democratic Alliance won 79 seats in a 230-seat National Assembly. The center-left Socialist Party, in power the past 8 years, got 77 seats. The hard-right Chega Party captured 48 seats in an unprecedented challenge to politics as usual, underscoring a drift to the right in the European Union. Police in northern England say they have removed 34 bodies from a funeral home and arrested a man and woman on suspicion of fraud and preventing lawful burials. The arrest Sunday follows several days of investigation of legacy funeral directors in Hull and two related funeral homes. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha, Washington. Today is Monday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's army throws cold water on international calls for a ceasefire during Ramadan.
These are conditions that cannot be met by the RSF because simply it means that RSF will surrender militarily while on the battlefield the realities dictate otherwise.
Former Ivory Coast President Babo accepts his party's nomination to stand for the 2025 elections. Rwanda provides a lesson on female empowerment during this Women's History Month. Campaigning in Senegal's long-delayed parliamentary and presidential election begins during Ramadan.
My knowledge, we have never organized election during the holy month of Ramadan. Election here in Senegal is associated with noises, and the Ramadan here is fully respected.
Those stories plus Samson Umali Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Sudan analyst is calling on the international community to exert maximum pressure on Sudan's warring parties to reach a ceasefire. The UN Security Council last Friday called for a truce before the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, will travel to Africa and the Middle East from March 11th to the 23rd. According to the State Department, the visit demonstrates the priority that the Biden administration places on ending the Sudan conflict. However, over the weekend, the assistant commander-in-chief of the Sudan's army rejected the calls for a ceasefire. Suleiman Baldo is the director of the Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He tells me that a ceasefire is not likely because of the Sudanese army's demands, which he says amounts to a complete surrender of the paramilitary rapid support forces.
It should be possible, but given the attitude of the belligerents, I believe there is a little chance that this call for ceasefire will be taken seriously by either of the belligerents. You know, they are actually the army came out with a very, let's say, harsh and conditionalities to observe a ceasefire or even enter into talks about a truce. And these are conditions that cannot be met by the RSF, because simply it means that RSF would surrender militarily while on the battlefield the realities dictate otherwise.
Talking about the conditions, one of them being that the RSF withdrawal from occupied cities in Darfur and Kordofan and the departure from Khartoum, the U.S. saying that doesn't seem possible.
These are conditions for total surrender. Sudan Armed Forces has not managed to reduce the RSF to that point whereby it is militarily defeated and therefore has to totally surrender, canton its fighters and withdraw from territories it occupied. On the contrary, you know, rapid support forces now occupy de facto all of Western Sudan except pockets in South Kordofan and West Kordofan. So the battleground has not given advantage to any of the two belligerents. So putting conditions of surrender of the RSF is not realistic, simply put.
In the meantime, U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, is traveling to Africa Monday, the 11th, with the emphasis of trying to bring peace to Sudan. Can you tell us your assessment of his coming trip?
I believe that the attempts to get the two parties to sit to a negotiating table to agree simply to a humanitarian ceasefire have been ongoing by the U.S. and other mediators, IGAD and African Union, since the beginning of the war. And this has given us no peace until today, which means the problem is in the stubbornness and the recklessness of the two parties. You know, they do not want to take into consideration the suffering of the people of Sudan. And therefore, the belligerents are really not going to heed calls or attempts to present new initiatives. I think the only way to impose a ceasefire is to exert maximum pressure that is coordinated between the U.S., the European Union, and the regional countries. They should all exert pressure on the two parties so that they come to some sense and agree to a break in the fight.
What would maximum pressure be like?
Abide by, non-direct intervention by regional actors. No party should extend military support for either party. Second, enforce interdiction of deliveries of weapons from regional actors. Third, really increase the economic pressures on their financial and corporate holdings so that the ability of the army, the rapid support forces to finance their military destructive efforts should be weakened and disrupted.
Suleiman Baldo is the director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He was speaking with us from the northeastern U.S. state of New Jersey. Campaigning began over the weekend for Senegal's long-delayed parliamentary and presidential election. This after the government announced that the polls would take place on March 24. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Khan tells me that while Senegalese are ready to finally cast their ballots, having the election during the month of Ramadan dampened some of the enthusiasm that usually comes with campaigning.
After all this drama that happened the last, let's say, 5 weeks, now everybody is tired and just want to go and vote and elect a new president.
Now, let's look at the calendar itself. It seems that the campaign itself is expected to last for just 2 weeks or less, and it will be taking place during the month of Ramadan. Are the candidates comfortable with this?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because to my knowledge, we have never organized election during the holy month of Ramadan. You know, election here in Senegal is associated with noises, is associated with music, is associated with an event that can mobilize people. And the Ramadan here is fully respected because 95% of the population in Senegal is Muslim. So that Ramadan is a period of pray, and people don't make noises, don't make music. Usually the campaign is the whole day. But Ramadan is fasting, and I don't see people organizing rallies in the afternoon where people are very, very tired. So they have to adjust all their agendas, all their meetings, maybe after we break the fasting, which will be in the night. And that itself has also another challenge, because people will have to go to work the following day.
So why do you think the campaign was scheduled during the month of Ramadan? Was it done in consultation with all the candidates?
No, I think people didn't have a choice. The Constitutional Council forced the government since February to really schedule the campaign. And they refused. They organized all these consultation and other things. And at the end of the day, the administration was forced by the Constitutional Council to organize it before April 2. I think people have now made their mind about who they're going to vote for and who they're not going to vote for.
And that's what I want to ask you. So is there anything such as advantage for any of the 19 approved candidates?
Well, I think there is equality between all of them, because I don't think that the 3 minutes every day on the TV will make a big difference between parties. And during the day, as I mentioned to you, it will be really, really very hard to mobilize people to participate in the rally. Maybe those who will be organizing small meeting in small areas in the cities, those are the people who have money, who have resources. So I think it will be a campaign of the strict minimum.
Let's talk briefly about candidate Diomaye Faye. We understand he's still in jail. Any idea when he's expected to be released before the start of the campaign?
Well, as far as I know, the law needs to be finally signed by the president, the law on amnesty, of course, and then published in our National Gazette. Yesterday, the head of the campaign is the one who went on TV to record the first speech of Diomaye Faye on the radio, because by today at 7:30, our national TV will start giving 3 minutes to all the candidates per day.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. In Ivory Coast, former President Laurent Gbagbo over the weekend accepted the nomination of the African People's Party of Ivory Coast, the PPACI, to stand for the 2025 elections. Gbagbo returned home in 2021 following his acquittal on war crimes charges by the International Criminal Court. Patrice Kouté is a member of the PPACI. He tells me that the party demands an overhaul of the electoral list and boundaries.
after his acquittal by the International Criminal Court, when he get back to Abidjan, he created a new party, Pan-African Party, PPRC, and then as normal, we as the members of that party, we asked him to stand for 2025. And he was not responding correctly by yesterday during the meeting with all the commission, all the most members of the party. He said clearly that he's very, very much prepared to be the candidate of our party. So from now, may each of us be, you know, like campaign propagandists. That's what it is. But they said some condition here, James. The first condition is the overall of the electoral list, the list for the voters, is not properly done. It's full of fraud. Secondly, the condition, you know, the President Gbagbo's name is not on the list. So we will fight for the audit for the electoral list. And the third one is like, you know, the boundaries, the electoral boundaries, is not properly done.
So how strong is the party and how strong is the former president? As you said, he has been out of the country for some time now. So how strong do you think your party is going to be?
In the collective memory of the Ivorian, the popularity of President Laurent Gbagbo is quite any region of the country. President Gbagbo is one of the politicians well known in here because as opponent, he was in power from 2000 to 2011. So, yes, popularity in terms of the really politician in this country, that is not a doubt. Secondly, yes, PPRC is a new party, but all the members are not new on the political field. We were FPE before. Now we are PPRC. It's exactly, he was talking about the envelope. He said, let's take the content of the envelope and give them the envelope. So, yes, James. Yes, it won't be easy, yeah, because he was out of the country for 15 years. But again, in collective memories, everyone in this country knows who's Gbagbo Laurent and who Gbagbo Laurent stand for. Gbagbo Laurent will stand for justice, equity, and love between people as Kwame Nkrumah.
Patrice Kouté is a member of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's new party of African People's Party of Ivory Coast, the PPACI. He was speaking with us from the Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 11th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. As the world celebrates Women's History Month this March, the issue of women's participation in political leadership, particularly parliament, continues to be a challenge for many countries. But according to the Inter-Parliamentary Union, Rwanda is one of the leaders with women representing 61% of its legislation. Fatuma Dangeiza is a Rwandan female member of parliament in the East Africa Legislative Assembly. She says it requires a political will and a leadership that favors women's participation in decision-making, as well as women organizing to advocate for their rights. Dangeiza received an award last week for her commitment to gender equality. She tells me the award is also a recognition of Rwandan women.
The award means a recognition for my contribution to women empowerment and gender equality. And indeed, it is a recognition of the efforts of Rwandan women for the last 30 years in the aftermath of 94 genocide, the journey of rebuilding their nation, but also gender empowerment and gender equality. So it's something to be proud about. But I think a tribute to Rwandan society.
I was reading that the Inter-Parliamentary Union says that Rwanda is the world leader when it comes to women participation in parliament. About 61% of Rwanda's parliament is women. So I'm wondering, what is the secret? How do you manage to get that level of participation?
Yeah, indeed. Women participation has been a challenge in many countries. And in Rwanda, I think the game changer has been two critical issues. One, it is the political will and leadership that has created enabling legislative policy and institutional frameworks that favor the participation of women in decision-making positions. But secondly, it is women organizing themselves to raise their voices, to advocate for their political rights. Like in the aftermath of genocide, we created a platform of women called the National Women Councils that brings together women from the grassroots level to the national level to be able to speak with one voice as Rwandans, advocate for their rights, but also build their capacity in leadership. You know, women, because of our cultural tradition in most societies, are always, they have low self-esteem, low confidence. So that was an opportunity really to build women's capacity, but women also to support each other, to freely participate in national issues, in community issues, and we are able to engender our constitution, one, to make sure that the issue of gender equality and parity was enshrined in our constitution, including equality and participation in decision-making, but more important was also introduction of what you call affirmative action that allowed women to have a minimum of 30% representation, and that goes again with the Beijing Platform for Action. And because of the activism that had been brought, women organizing themselves, being trained for leadership and prepared for that, then the Constitution also giving them that right. That's when in 2003, when we went for election, for the first time we had around 48%. And today, as we speak, it's 61%.
When you talk to women in other African countries, some of the challenges they cite is a lack of political will and money. Now, you are Secretary General of the East African
Women Caucus.
Yes. So how do you think the Rwanda experience can be transplanted to other countries?
Of course, we know that every context is unique and there's no one size that fits all, but there are similarities when it comes to the issue of women empowerment and gender equality across the globe. I still believe that political will and commitment, we have to mobilize our politicians, our leadership, from the president, our parliaments, our executive, so that they support the participation of women in leadership and also remove all the barriers. And that's when you need to have the laws, like here in Rwanda, we needed to also to make sure that we also promote the economic rights of women. The second issue for me, I think that the rest of the world can also learn, as I said, is the creating that enabling environment. You need to have strong institutions. Like here, we have what you call gender monitoring office, which now monitors every government institution, every ministry, whether they are mainstreaming gender and the concerns of women. The other lesson that maybe the rest can learn from us is the issue of male involvement. You know, in most societies, when you talk about gender equality, it's as if it's a war between men and women. But for us, we took it as a societal challenge. It's these societal norms and perceptions about feminine and masculinity, the issue of stereotypes. So we thought this is a society issue, and men have to be our allies. So in our journey, even with making sure that we have women in leadership, we had to talk to men, we had to engage men, we had to explain, raise awareness, but also show men that empowerment of women, including political participation, is really beneficial to the family, to the society, and because of that, men have been supportive.
Fatuma Nagiza is a Rwanda female member of parliament and also a member of the East African Legislative Assembly. She spoke with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Burundi's main opposition party was split on Sunday after a faction said they had ousted its leader, Agathon Rwasa, for failing to unify the two sides. Rwasa was deposed as the head of the suspended National Freedom Council, the CNL, at a General Assembly in the north of the country, the party sources and witnesses said. According to the French news agency, the AFP, the 60-year-old former militia leader was replaced by a senior executive at a state-owned company.
formed in 2019, the CNL was suspended last year by the government of the Central African country, which accused it of irregularities. Critics say the move by the Interior Ministry was an attempt to stifle dissent ahead of the 2025 legislative elections and risk returning the country to political turmoil. The party's Secretary General, Simon Bizimungu, denounced Raza's removal, saying it went against the country's constitution. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with Africa Club football. The race is on for Africa clubs to secure the remaining places at the FIFA's new 32-team Club World Cup tournament, which makes its debut in the United States in 2025. Two of the continent's four qualification spots have already been claimed by recent CAF Champions League winners, Al Hakli of Egypt and Morocco's Wydad Casablanca. Al Hakli booked their ticket by virtue of winning the 2022-2023 editions of Africa's Premier Club competition. Wydad, meanwhile, qualified after their 2021-2022 Champions League triumph under the tutelage of history-making coach Walid Regragui. The two remaining African berths will go into the winners of the current 2023-2024 Champions League campaign and the highest-ranked side based on FIFA's club coefficient rankings. South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns and Aspirants of Tunisia are the only two clubs still in contention to claim that ranking spot should Al Hakli or Wydad win the season's CAF Champions League. Kenya is on course to host the 2024 CAF-organized CHAN tournament that will be jointly hosted by Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania in September 2024. The East African countries will also host AFCON in 2027. A team from CAF has inspected stadium facilities in Kakamega County, Bukuhugu, Mambolo, Nyanyo, and Ulizin Sport Complex to ascertain the progress of work being done so far. Hussein Mohammed is the CEO of Extreme Sports of Kenya.
The government is committed. I think Kenyans are very excited. We need to move with speed, definitely. And I'm confident we'll be able to pull it off. We just need a very strong team to execute the implementation or the preparation of AFCON. I think government has shown commitment. And it's up to all stakeholders now to pull together and ensure it's a success. AFCON cannot be done just by government. It needs everybody on board. It needs a very strong federation. It needs the fans. It needs Kenyans to collaborate to make sure that we have a very successful event like it has never been seen before.
In cycling, organizers of this year's Cape Town Cycle Tour say the event has been a success and has gone off without any major glitches. The race was started in 1978 as a protest event and has evolved into one of the biggest international cycling showpieces. It generates millions of rand for charity and is a major cash injection for the host city. A total of 27,000 cyclists from 52 countries participated in the 46th installment of the cycle tour. David Belairs is the cycling event director.
It's a huge event and there's an unbelievable team behind it. This is a year's worth of work. The logistics are phenomenal.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, March 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
Greetings. This is VOA's Sunny Young. Brighten your day by tuning in the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. You can also follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and VOAAfrica.com. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice.